Anyways, so we have two roving mics. We record everything, so we ask you to use a mic when you have a question, and also do the guidance on who's first and who's next. So do we have a mic placed with someone so far? That gentleman right there, Ann?
Thank you for coming and speaking. I enjoyed your talk very much. I have a sense as an older senior citizen that there's a lack of a sense of community. I was on my uncle's farm for about 5 years as a boy, and the sense of community was very strong. If there was a wayward child, the community pitched in. If there was someone who had an alcohol problem, the community got together. In this modern urban environment, the lack of a sense of community leaves us to feel the government will look after it, the police will look after it, somebody else will look after it. Should we not be taking control and responsibility in our own communities?
You have a really good point, and I think a lot of people feel that it's not possible to have a community when you live in a high rise or whatever it is. Actually, as you know, it is. It just takes one or two people to work on their own floor or organize the meeting in the basement or whatever it might be to establish that, and you can actually provide a lot of your own public safety, if you like, once you all know each other and know who belongs in the building and who doesn't. So I think, and you've seen neighborhoods, you know, the Little Italy and the various areas of Toronto that are kind of communities of their own, and I think that can work. It has to work, because that's everybody's moving to the city except me. So, yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Next, do we have someone right there? There we go.
Well, thank you for your talk. I agree with everything that you say, and I just wonder, in your experience, how have policymakers responded to the obvious condition where these alternative methods do work, they are successful, and they are cheaper? Mm-hmm. Are they just are politicians pandering to a base? And a second part of that question is there any research that suggests that Canadians generally are in favor of harsher prison sentences?
Let me start with the second first. I don't know at the moment what a public poll would show you about that. I do know, and Tony Doob has been here, a local criminologist has been here to talk to you about this. I do know that when it's all about information, the public comes around right smart once they've got real information, and he proved it by just asking people, here's this manslaughter case, what do you think? The guy got 6 months. And they'd, oh God, that somebody died there. That's not right. That should have been a much longer sentence. Then he sits them down and gives them the information. Here's what happened. And I've forgotten the details, but it was obviously a case where leniency was required, at the end of which the people he was talking to would say, 6 months for that? He shouldn't have gotten 6 months for that. So you can flip people really fast once they've actually got the information. They never get it. What they get is the front headlines. They don't get the backstory. And that's part of our job, I think, as people like me, is to try and give them the backstory. I've often said that 99% of the guys I knew were the boy next door, and sometimes literally. Sometimes I met people who grew up just down the road from me. They were just guys, and something bad happened. Something really, it could have been a drug abuse situation, complicated by a fight in the bar, you know, complicated by some kind of mental things going on. And boom, they're in Millhaven Special Handling Unit. You have to be able to understand that they're all people. They're not monsters. That's what victims want out of a system. They want to face the man and realize he's not a monster. He's this pathetic little person who just had all these problems and he took them out on me. You know, that's what we need to convey to people, I think. I've forgotten the first part of your question. I'm sorry.
Case of when politicians...
Oh, pandering.
Yeah, pandering to a
pandering.
Base.
I'll tell you, it's just such an unpopular file, and I just don't think there are enough spokespeople in our public life, the characters in public life, with great knowledge of this, so they just don't know how to handle those kinds of questions sensibly. I was interested, though, to see somebody like Bill Blair, your former police chief, for whom I, you know, don't carry a brief particularly after that G20 meeting, but, you know, the man knows a lot about this question, and he just says, we don't need to be incarcerating all these people. We need to incarcerate the dangerous ones. So why would someone not listen to him? You know, he knows something about this. And I think he's got a good position. We don't. We just need to incarcerate the ones we're really worried about. And there aren't many of them. So, yeah, I guess it is pandering, because it's pandering to a segment of the population that just doesn't have the knowledge. They just don't. They watch TV, and that's what they think is the word on criminal justice.
The next question, right here, Anne.
I would like to thank you for giving us a good speech and a lot of information. My question relates to what's happening right now currently, and I know a lot of people are worried about the statements from the chief of police and...
From whom?
From the chief of police here in
yes.
Toronto. And recently, the statement of one of the counselors in one of the wards that openly said that there's something wrong with our laws, we need to fix them. This is after a shooting happened 2 days ago. The dissemination of this information is going to create a lot of difficulties going forward. And I'm sure you're also aware that there are many changes that are going to come. Some of them have already come into place that is going to make it very, very difficult for persons accused to get a fair trial and to get a fair deal with bail. There will be changes coming in December. There will be a change in honors in certain situations, from crown honors to reverse honors. There's also a cancellation or, to a certain extent, a limitation to a right to a preliminary inquiry now in certain offenses. So this is making the criminal justice system even more difficult for an individual person. So I wanted to raise those concerns, and I hope people here are going to write to their ward counselors, and if we can have that information provided to them, that this is a worrying trend. We know we have an issue in this city with regard to the shooting, but fixing the criminal justice system in the way they want us to fix it will really make it worse.
Worse, yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. And the other thing that Bill Blair has said is you can't arrest yourself out of a problem like this. You can't arrest yourself out of the drug problem, which is still a possibility for them. But he said it's not possible. You can't. And I guess, where to start? Again, pay attention to what's going on elsewhere. Glasgow was known to be, I think, the most violent city in the European Union or something. It's a ridiculous amount of violence. It wasn't so much guns, because guns are not the issue in the UK so much. It was knives. And they got their act together as a city, and I'm not going to go into the details because I don't remember all of them, but it was, again, a case of putting the programs in place up front, keeping those folks out of prison, and they have in a very short few years managed to bring themselves back up to a state where you're not terrified every time you walk down the street in Glasgow. They're actually a shining light for people who are trying to make those kinds of transitions. And, you know, I don't know how easy something like that would be to do in a place like Toronto when it's guns. And, you know, you've got to get them off the street. You've got to get those off the street. But you've also got to, whoever the perpetrators are, you've got to sit them down. Let me do a little divergence for a second. This is how wild the ideas can be. Take this one with you, though. In California, in a suburb of Los Angeles, there was so much murder happening among the drug gangs there that something new was required. And what they did was set up a program where they brought in the big kingpins, all the big heavies, 60 of them or something, into a room, various gangs in the same room. And they said, if you will come to a meeting next week where we're going to do the following, you will all receive a check for $1,000. Okay, so they all came and they did that. And they sat down and talked about what the problem was. And then they said, we'll go on an excursion. We'll take you all to, they took them to Washington, flew them all to Washington, looked at all the monuments and the mall and that, and back and had a nice meal, a good hotel, all paid for. But the catch was they had to pair up with somebody from the opposite, from the gang, the rival gang. So they sat together in the plane with the guy, huh? Went to the dinner with the guy. And of course, before long, they recognized they were each just people. They each had the same, some of the same interests. They weren't vicious nasties. And people, they stopped shooting each other. And I remember thinking, whoa, you know, that seems a little excessive, paying people not to kill each other. I don't know if that's... not to shoot each other, but it was successful. Most of them actually survived the experiment and went on to live long, healthy life and so on. So, I mean, the most bizarre things can work. If you've got the right people in place to put this stuff into place, it's amazing what works. And it really is about us and them. Once you've caught on that we're all just us, everything changes. But I take your point, and I think I'd be worried as well. And again, it's if you've got to lobby your locals and try and say, no, this is not the way we want to go.
Next question, back there.
Thank you for your presentation, very illuminating. Two things, if I might. I would like to have an example or two of the, you mentioned a group of 14 members of the community who decided what should happen instead of a ticket or going to jail. And the second thing is, where is privatization of prisons? And I think that's happening in Canada as well as the U.S. And is that driving for more incarceration due to increased profit for the companies? Or what is the impact there?
Yeah, it's we had our little experiment with that, which was such a dud they never did it again. They tried to run Penetang through a privatized outfit, and 5 years in, they did the study and said, no, this is actually increasing, jeopardizing public safety. It's not doing the job. It's costing more. It was a big bust, so they never did do it again. But they have used private outfits to build prisons. So Toronto South Detention Center, for example, was built privately, $1.3 billion, I think, to house over 1,000 prisoners, which, by the way, is against all UN, everything we've ever signed at the United Nations. You're not supposed to have more than 500 people in a prison, but anyhow. They've done that. They're now planning one for Ottawa, and I don't know if it's a private outfit or not. But no, privatization came a cropper fairly quickly in Canada, and I hope it stays that way. Because in the States, when they would do this, they would offer to take over. These companies would roll into a state and offer to take over their prisons for them and run them, but only if they would guarantee 90% occupancy. And you probably know about the judge that himself went to jail because he was taking kickbacks for sending young offenders to the particular prison that these guys were running. So your first part was about the Vancouver court, the community court, I think they called it, and the 14 businesses involved, I have no idea, but I think what it would be, I think what I remember is, you know, the shops where the shoplifting was happening all the time, those guys, the lovely storefront with the, you know, the shishi al fresco dining with people going up and down with the grocery carts, those guys, they've got an interest in trying to clean up the street. And so those are the people, just the locals who had been expressing real concerns and complaining about what was happening on the street, wanted to find a different way of cleaning it up than just taking them and moving them to prison, you know. Yeah. They actually held, it is a court, they actually bring the folks to the court, the people that are getting tickets otherwise, bring them to the court, sit them down, Talk about what the problem is. Do you understand that if you keep stealing from my store, I'm going to have to go out of business and that sort of thing. And then try to find a way to help them out of the situation they're in. So here we go. This is Vancouver. So you're talking. Helping them find housing. Helping them find some stability in respect of their drug use. Helping them, you're going to find mental illness throughout this story for sure. And so helping them find help with that. Sometimes it's so simple and the problem is solved, And it costs nothing. It's not costing anything. So, and it's really just about the milk of human kindness. It's just about trying to treat people decently and find a better solution. And they seem to be doing so. And that's one I'd like to see spread around. I think Toronto could use a little bit of that.
Right here, Ben. This gentleman?
Just in a sentence or two, could you elaborate on the cash bail? You said that you'd like to see eliminated.
Yes.
So what's the default position? Is it the judge or justice who's hearing the case initially? It's her responsibility to make a determination as to whether it's likely that the alleged defendant will not harm others? And in the absence of that determination, not put them in custody, or put them in custody despite the fact that by definition not guilty?
Yeah, here's the thing about cash bail. You're given a bail, a release order. You're either detained, in which case that you're out of luck, or you're given a release order, and that a bail order. And that order might say put $1,000 cash down, provide two sureties in the amount of $2,000, whatever. And where it falls down is normally is with the cash part of it. So my suggestion to you is, if the judge has already decided that you're not a risk, which is what they're deciding when they give you bail, you're not a risk. So what's this about? Why would you be going to prison? If you can't pay the cash, you can't pay the cash. And so why even do that? In the States, as you know, there's a great brouhaha right now about cash bail because they have bail bondsmen down there. A lot of guys making a buck, making a good living as bail bondsmen. They don't want to see that disappear. So there's a big fight on about that. But it's generally agreed that that's one of the things we have to get rid of. It's a dollar economy, everything, hey? And this is your life, though. I mean, cash bail can mean everything. You could literally be languish in a prison with people who've done everything from murder to pickpocketing and be there because you can't come up with that money. And yet your judge has decided that you're okay to go as long as you put that money down. That doesn't make any sense to me, and I'd like to see it disappear. So.
I wonder if you could speak to Bill C-83, which is supposed to eliminate segregation, solitary confinement, which was renamed administrative segregation. It sounds like it's just the same thing being rebranded.
Yeah, I don't have to add much to what you've just said. They gave it a fancy new name, and they put it out there. They changed a couple of things. You get an extra hour in the yard or something, and you might be able to make a call to your family once in a blue moon. But the bottom line is the warden gets to decide. I mean, if there's supposed to be a cap on how long they let you stay in there, but the warden can just do what he or she wants. I mean, you can be in there for as long as the warden wants, which is, was so disappointing from this government. That's just not even sensible, and it wasn't even a serious try at a change. And that's what I despair about, because they'll put that out there as if you're supposed to go, oh, wow, how enlightened, what a great idea. And then you look at the small print and realize these guys don't want to change anything at all. So fight them when they do that, and tell them what they're doing wrong. Tell them this doesn't work. When I think of that young man in Thunder Bay for 4 years, I mean, the man lost his mind. And he'd still be there if some guard with a conscience hadn't sidled up to the human rights head and said, did you know about this guy? Otherwise, he'd be dead by now. He wouldn't have survived it. So yeah, it's a travesty, really, that kind of legislation.
Respecting everybody's time, just perhaps one question. And one more back there.
I think you stopped us all in our tracks when we saw what the gap was between what Canada does and what Holland does. Now, short of a field trip, how do we close that?
Oh, thanks for the question. Oh, dear. I think you just keep putting those examples in front of your politicians. I mean, this has to come from politics, these changes. And we look like a throwback. We look like Charles Dickens' workhouses by comparison to what's happening in Scandinavia in particular, but not limited to them. I mean, there's so many examples in that part of the world. Finland was in the orbit of the Soviet Union for all those years, as you know, and it had a terrible record of incarceration, high numbers. And when that fell apart, when the Soviet bloc was over, they looked at each other, and being who they are, because Finns are very socially conscious, they pay a lot of taxes and they provide a lot of help for their people in education and medical and just everything. And they decided they needed to reduce the numbers in their prisons, and they just went and did it. And, well, how hard was that? It wasn't hard at all. In their case, one of the things they did was to decriminalize drunkenness. The Soviet Union, it was vodka day and night. It really was. And people were, you know, this was a big problem, and they were sending them to prison, so they stopped doing that. Well, now we've stopped doing it with marijuana possession. But did you know that when they legalized marijuana possession and the growing of four plants, that they also added there's a whole bunch of new legislation there, reasons why they can put you in prison. So you can still go for trafficking, and you can still go for growing five plants, you can still go for any number of other infractions around marijuana. So we're not even there with that yet, much less dealing with cocaine and heroin and crystal meth and the rest of it. It's all big trouble, and until we get a grip of it, which we cannot do while it's illegal, it's just never going to be over. So,
thank you. I think you referred to several parts of this case, but there was a little girl murdered. It was a sexual abuse and a murder by a couple. And the woman who is incarcerated, it was determined, I believe, by the courts that she should spend time in an indigenous home out west. Mm-hmm. And the father campaigned against that because it was not a strong enough deterrent, I guess, or I guess it was something that she deserved to be in for much longer. Mm-hmm. How do you measure those things? She's going to be out when she's not that old, regardless of how long she spends. I don't know, life is what, 25 years, and she was 19 or something when they did it. So she's going to be out at a time when it would be good if she were productive and there was something going on to assist in this. How do you manage the emotional sort of part of a horrendous crime like this, yes, and yet be fair to the victim and the perpetrator?
Yeah, it's complicated, and I think you do it much the way I was describing earlier. You have to find a way to communicate to both sides and communicate to the victims or the family of the victims that what you're trying to accomplish here is the best thing for everybody. Sending buddy down for 25 years is not a solution for anything. Did you know that our first mandatory minimum sentence was 25 years with no parole for murder? And they did that because they were trying to get around the capital punishment thing. That was the trade-off. It turned out, and then the hope was that number would be reduced over time, because if you're in Scandinavia and you kill somebody, you're not going to go down for 25 years on that. The average time somebody might spend there would be somewhere between 10 and 15 years. Our people were getting out at close to 30 years. So don't let anybody ever tell you that we're not tough on crime. We already are. In a case like that one, very emotional, you had a speaker not long ago who was the mother of a two-year-old toddler who had been killed by a neighbor. And that was another story, very emotional. But she was there making a position as a victim for this, essentially for the woman who'd done the killing. She was not found to be not criminally responsible, which means you don't go to prison in the same way, at least, or for as long. And she was there to advocate for making sure people in those conditions don't spend their whole lives, you know, and die in prison, which is what's happening.
Yes. Is that indigenous home, or the place she was sent,
yes,
is this a proper alternative for this sort of thing? Like, is it something that actually does work? And if it does, then why aren't we incorporating more of that and doing education around it?
Yep. Yes, it's... She's still in custody. Some of our prisons here in Kingston don't have walls, but you're still in custody. You're still in trouble if you waltz out of there. So she's still in custody, and that is that's a very serious burden to bear. It's not like being in the Kingston Penitentiary for women. It's not as ugly, but it's still custody. And what they were trying to do with those healing lodges was build a place where women could go to learn what they needed to learn about themselves so they'd be okay when they got back on the street, whenever that was, and be closer to their own families and communities while doing that. Because for a century, any woman doing more than 2 years, 2 years or more, went to Kingston. So if you're from Whitehorse, that doesn't work. Like, you're not going to know anybody by the time you get back. So it was a good idea to try to build these healing lodges across the country. Unfortunately, it had a net widening effect because judges thought, oh, she doesn't have to go to Kingston. She can just go down this road, you know, to the whatever it is south of Saskatoon and go there. And they started actually incarcerating more rather than fewer women as a result. So that was the horrible backlash there. But to be more specific to your question, it doesn't really matter if you're sitting in a place with razor wire and that, or you're sitting where she would be in the country so far from any place that there wouldn't be any point trying to walk away anyhow. You're still confined. She's still suffering. She's still doing her time the best way she can. I think that's important.
Good. You've been a very patient audience. I thank you. It's now 2:00. If any of you do want to talk with Paul, she'd be happy to meet you up here. And with that, just keep in mind our next event is in January, and our headliner is the one and only Harry Nye. So I encourage you to come. It'll be a very interesting panel discussion.